This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Domestic violence is our topic this afternoon, and we're hoping to have two guests for this interview portion of the Afternoon Magazine. One of them is with us here in the studio. Her name is Tammy Tunnell. She's the program director for A Woman's Place. The Champaign-Urbana Domestic Violence Shelter is one of the oldest in the country. It was founded in 1971. And this is the mission statement for A Woman's Place. Our mission is to eliminate violence against women. And until that happens, to provide safety and support to survivors of that violence as they take control of their own lives. And we're hoping this afternoon at some point to make a connection with Hannah Niala. She survived and escaped 7 years of physical and emotional abuse at the hands of her husband. She fled with their daughter and son, but her husband found them and abducted the children. It was at that point that she's... Let me also mention that Hannah Niala is an alumnus of the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, and she is the author of the memoir, Point Last Seen, A Woman Tracker's Story of Domestic Violence and Personal Triumph. And Hannah is now with us on the telephone. As we talk, Hannah, Tammy, and I, we welcome your comments and questions. Here are the phone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Toll-free 1-800-222-WILL and in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Tammy, Hannah, good afternoon and welcome to the program.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Sure.
Thank you.
Hannah, I would like to begin with you and your story. You fell in love with your first husband, Kevin, at the age of 17. How did you meet?
Oh, we met through church, ironically enough, like a lot of young people do, I think. Met in a young people's group, had pizza, all utterly, terribly, terribly ordinary ways of meeting and getting to know someone.
And what was he like? Why did you fall in love with him?
He was actually a great person, is actually a great person in many, many ways. Nothing has changed my mind about that through the years. He was bright, articulate, intelligent, caring, had a real gentle spirit, very sensitive side, wrote poetry, liked music, all of the kinds of qualities that I liked most in a person he seemed to have. And after I had agreed to marry him, I started learning that he had some real horrors in his life, some very, very sad times. He'd been abused as a child. He'd had a really, really rough childhood. No one coming to his defense. That is not a reason to stop loving someone. That's a reason actually to care for them more and to want to nurture them and try to help make the last years of their lives better than the first years were. And so that made me, ironically, love him even more.
Mm. And what, after 7 years, finally got you to the point where you said, I love this guy, but I've got to get out of here?
Mm. He started hitting me within the first 6 months that we were married. The emotional control and that sort of thing started actually before we married, shortly before our wedding actually occurred. By the end of the first year, physical abuse was common. He would beat me, he would choke me, he would do some really horrendous things. These kinds of abuse stories go right hand in hand, sadly enough, with also very deep love, I think. And on his part, in the first year or two anyway, with an awful lot of guilt and sincerely meaning his apologies when he would make them afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
After a while of living that way, though, eventually the apologies became less clear. And I would say by the third year that I was married to him, he wasn't sorry anymore. He did not express regret for what he did, except in very manipulative ways. And it was always my fault then. Mm-hmm. I had burned something. I had forgotten a butter knife on the table. I had forgotten to put the salt shakers in the right spot on the table. I didn't have dinner ready precisely when he came in. Whatever it was, there were always very good reasons on his part for what he did. The reason I left 7 years later was not because I couldn't stand it anymore, not because I thought that leaving would help us to survive. I did not. He had told me repeatedly that if I ever left him, he would kill us, and I believed him right down to the word. And the reason I left was because the beatings had become absolutely unstoppable. For about the last month that I was there, I did not sleep one night through. I did not get to finish one meal without extreme physical violence taking place. I lost 15 pounds in a matter of just a few days. The pressure was horrendous. And he had choked me unconscious one night on coming in, and I realized that if I died, my children would be left there with him without anybody to protect them. And I made up my mind that if I survived that night, I would take the two kids and at least choose a better place for our death. I did not want to die in a cowering in a corner of his house, and that's what I did.
Let me bring Tammy Tunnell into the conversation now and ask her for her thoughts. Tammy's the program director for A Woman's Place, which is a domestic violence shelter in Champaign-Urbana. Tammy?
Well, thank you. And Hannah, I have read your book, and I picked it up, started reading it, and didn't put it down until I was finished. And as you were talking, I was thinking about what I'd read in your book, which, you know, is all in there, and I highly recommend it to anybody listening to pick it up and read it. One point I think she made right away was, this was an ordinary person. He didn't have a tattoo on his forehead saying, I abuse people. That's what happens. You know, they're always ordinary, and you wouldn't believe this is going to happen. And I think if a person on the first date hit somebody or did some kind of thing that would say, this is what you're going to live with when you marry me, we probably wouldn't be marrying these kind of people. But they don't. And I think another good point was, you know, hearing his story and knowing what he lived through made him that much more lovable. And you can love somebody, but it doesn't mean you can live with them. So I think it was, you know, when you said that, it just made all the sense in the world to me as somebody who works in this mm-hmm. movement. And when you talk about cowering in the corner, I remember reading that in the book. And a lot of times people choose to get out when the children are somehow involved, whether they're being abused or when you realize, if he kills me, this is who they have to live with. And you always have to believe a battered woman when she says, he's going to kill me, because she knows best.
Mm. Tammy, you're the program director at A Woman's Place. Maybe you would tell us briefly what your job entails.
Well, that's a little bit of everything. It's overseeing the program, which operates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which means we're there day, evening, overnight, holidays. There's always somebody, a live person in that shelter working. So I function as backup to all the staff. So if somebody is missing because we've lost that position, they've left us, or they're sick on vacation, I'm the person that fills in for them. I also take care of all the program statistics, reporting, grant writing, mm-hmm. PR, do a lot of the things such as this, talking about domestic violence in the community.
And you've been in this line of work for some time. How did you get started?
Quite by accident. In 1986, I saw an ad for a job that wanted a certified paralegal, which I am, was at that point. And it didn't really explain much about it. It was for a place called Against Domestic Violence. What was that? I didn't even know what the term meant. I was fresh out of college, applied for the job, and when I got called for an interview, ran to the nearest library to look for a book. They had exactly one book in the library on domestic violence and had never been checked out. So I checked it out, read it cover to cover, and went in knowing at least what I was talking about, but had no idea.
Yeah. Now, Hannah, when you were living with your first husband, Kevin. It was the 1980s. Were you aware of, you know, this thing we now call domestic violence, and you know, how, you know, what was your understanding of what was going on and what was happening to you and your family?
My understanding was, I think largely at that time, I'd never heard the word domestic violence. I still think it's a very strangely sanitized set of words to
it
use.
It is, isn't it?
I prefer to call it family violence, and that helps a little bit because at least it starts to put some feet on the word.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd never heard the term. I did not know of anyone who beat their wives. But I was so tightly bound into that relationship, so far from my own family and the people who could have intervened had they known what was going on. I was so isolated from any possibility of close friendship or anyone else, because he really controlled pretty much my every move, that all I knew about my situation was what I was facing on a daily basis. It was the ways that I learned to deal with it, to try to head off the violence, to try to find a way to appease him before it got there. All of those sorts of things were all I knew. I did pick up the phone on the last day that I was there, the day before I left, actually, thinking that I would try to call a helpline. There was an 800 crisis line that had been advertised at that point on TV, and just like in the last couple weeks or so before I left. And I picked up the phone to dial that, and he came in. And I said that I was calling the bank, and proceeded to call the bank, actually. But that was all I knew of it at that
mm-hmm.
time. I did not know any more than that. There were not very many resources. And even today, ironically, that there are so many resources and we are getting so much better educated about this, I think that we still have a situation where people who are in this are often terribly, terribly isolated and have no ability to be able to reach out to those resources easily.
Yeah. In your book, Hannah, Point Last Seen, it comes across loud and clear how important it was for you after you were on your own to link up with others, to lose that isolation, and help others.
Right. That's my whole message, I guess. I mean, a huge part of my message is that it's the isolation and the shame that allows family violence to continue. The very first time my ex-husband hit me was in a public parking lot, and I was looking straight ahead, and there was a man in a pickup truck looking at me. And when my ex-husband's fist hit my face, I looked away, of course, but the man did too at the same time and drove away. I have been in this precise situation myself since then. I often intervene, actually, physically, vocally, 911, or put myself right in the middle of it. I don't advise that for people. But I do think that we have to kind of systematically start trying to make connections between ourselves that we have tended to lose as we've moved further away from the small-town mentality, the notion of taking care of your neighbors. We tend to shut our eyes. We don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a McDonald's last summer, and a young man there took his son by the ear and lifted him up off the floor. And I turned completely mute, inarticulate. I did not know what to say. I knew that if I said something, it would probably make that man angrier. And then the child would just have to deal with it because they were traveling. They were clearly touristing, they wouldn't be there 3 minutes for the cops to get there. And I went home and carried the shame of that for the longest time. And then it came to me very, very strongly that we have to find a way to reach the humanity of those people, even in instances like that. And I have, in other situations, done that. A woman was spanking her child very, very hard. She's very angry with this child in a grocery store one day, And I dropped one of the cans of the food that I was holding deliberately so that it would roll over by her foot so that I'd have to apologize to her when I picked it up. And then I just said, you know, it's really hard to be a parent and bring kids in to these places these days. They get so tired, don't they? And it was like something broke in her. She just sighed really big and said, yes, it really is. I think it's time for us to go home. And not in an angry way. Now, that didn't fix that problem. That didn't make it okay. But in a situation where you don't have 911, I think we sometimes have to intervene.
Yeah. I'm going to mention an experience that I had that was quite disturbing. Some years ago, I lived in a house that was divided into two apartments, and I lived on the top floor. And down below, there was a horrible, horrible fight going on between a woman and her boyfriend. And I was so frightened. And actually, there had been a very bad storm, so the phone was out. So I had to leave the house and go to a neighbor, and I called 911. And only to have this woman later come to me that same night and say, how dare you?
Mm-hmm.
And so
That's very reasonable on her part, actually. I think that's important to note.
Okay.
Absolutely reasonable. She is trying to preserve survival there. And she's on the front lines, and all of us who call 911 are way back in the trenches. You know, we're really safe. And she's on the front line. And in some ways, that is the, I mean, 911 is not the Band-Aid that we want it to be. The cops cannot fix those situations. Even with mandatory arrests, et cetera, still the person who's in the situation is the one who is going to have to deal with it when it all comes down. And I agree. I think sometimes you have to call 911. I've certainly done it. I've also tried those some informal things. When I lived in Illinois, I lived in an apartment building where my neighbor beat his wife regularly. And it was so fresh and so raw to me that I would be in the corner furthest from them in my house just cowering and crying several evenings a week. And finally one night I just got fed up, and I got up and I baked a batch of chocolate chip cookies, and I walked to their door and knocked on the door, and I did this, hi, you know, I'm from Mississippi, and I made y'all some cookies, and I'd just really like to get to know you. And I was lying through my teeth for the first 5 minutes. I didn't want to get to know that man. I wanted him to stop hitting that woman. But in 5 minutes, I was getting to know him, and I was seeing him as a human being. And after that, when the argument would get loud or whatever, I didn't call 911 because we had done that before and it didn't work with that situation.
Mm-hmm.
I just started singing, or I'd go outside my little door and water a plant. You know, it nearly died because it got a lot of water that it shouldn't have had. But you cannot behave these ways when somebody is watching. You know, you have to back off a little bit. Now, again, it did not solve her problem. It did not make it completely go away. But it never again went to that extent while I lived there. And hopefully there was some place at which the woman was able to make, you know, to do something different about it.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Well, it scared me to death.
Right. They're on the lines, though.
Yeah.
And we're back in the trenches. And I think that somehow we have to find even more creative ways, other ways of trying to help people who are in these situations than the ones we're already working with.
Yeah. Tammy, you have any thoughts, any ideas on this?
Well, I would like to comment. She's very correct in that it is that woman who has to deal with it. And what's likely to happen when the police show up is they're going to walk onto a scene where he's completely calm, cool, and collected, and they're going to term her hysterical. Because safety has arrived all of a sudden, and she's going to deal with it in a way that is not logical. Because domestic violence or family violence, it doesn't make any sense. Usually you think if someone's going to leave you, you're going to beg them to stay, do the hearts, flowers, candy routine. And sometimes it's the opposite. They will beat you into submission so you don't leave. So a lot of times I've heard police officers say, I got there, he was fine, she was hysterical. And we try to teach them when we have the opportunity that that's normal. That's what you should expect when you walk up into a scene where you've been called either by either of those parties or, say, the neighbor. So it is very true. She does have to deal with it. And sometimes she turns on the police officers only because she's now safe and has an outlet. And it doesn't always, again, make sense. And people have to realize that this particular subject never makes any sense.
Hannah, something else that I found really disturbing in your book that I just felt myself being outraged at the injustice of it, because you fled. A judge in Oklahoma, I believe, ruled that you, not your husband, was at fault, and you had taken the children and deserted him. And, you know, that leads me to ask, you know, this, we can see now how complicated this whole thing is. How best can a woman get herself and her children out of a life and death situation and not get into that bind of being the one found at fault?
That's the $64 million question, the one that sends cold chills down my spine. Every time it comes to me, because we are doing, people like Tammy are devoting their lives to make a difference so that judges understand a little better than the one in my case. And the fact that he listened to 2 days of testimony from police officers, we had dental records, we had medical records about the abuse that my ex had done to me. The judge disallowed that and still ruled that I had deserted my ex-husband. And thus, he had the greater right to the children at that time. And that is not unique. That's not just Oklahoma. We have litigated this case now in a number of states because he has proceeded to stalk us, and it is the same thing in every state we've been in, except Wisconsin. We have found a little bit of help here. What I would say that people need more than anything else, first of all, is they need other human beings who know the situation. And this does not necessarily mean cops and judges. They need documentation. I mean, letters, pictures, everything that they can possibly get. They need to write down everything that happens. And all of these things put them in grave danger. But without it, it's almost impossible to get a court to listen and make a ruling which will allow the woman and any children to be safe long enough to back the man off. First line of defense these days are the shelters, the places that people like Tammy are running, because a lot of times they can help you put the case together. And sometimes if you're so isolated from your family and friends that you cannot speak to them about it, the best thing to do is get on the line to that shelter. They will come and get you. They will make you safe at the first line. And then from that point, you're going to have to work like hell with them to be able to really be safe. Sometimes it will span years, the fights, for that. Sometimes you will have to relocate. It depends on how seriously concerned the man is about it and how far he's going to go to track you down.
Do your children feel safe?
No, they do not. They're 17, almost 18, and almost 21 right now. Despite the fact that the book they feel like is making a difference and helping other people, and the fact that I know that finally, if something were to happen to me, he would not have easy access to them to terrorize. Somebody now would step in, because enough people know now that they would do something to help my children, even if I were no longer here. And I never knew that until a couple years ago. But they feel that he's not finished, that there has been a little bit of a lull over the last year or so. And I'm taking that with a great deal of hope and not thinking too far ahead in terms of, well, he'll be back. We still are very, very alert. But my children are convinced that he will start again, because he always has in the past. During the time that they were with him, they were physically and sexually, mentally abused horrendously. it has taken years for them to get to the place where they can just deal with all of that and function with it. And that all said, they're bright, articulate, wonderful human beings who are giving something back to the world already, and I believe that this ugly stuff is going to just make them even better able to do it. Mm-hmm. But no, they do not feel safe.
Yeah. Tammy, is this a situation that women and kids often find themselves in?
Oh, yeah. I think, for one, the fleeing from place to place is a lot more common than people are aware of, simply because people don't feel they can go and talk to anybody about it. And the isolation, that is a key factor in keeping people in these situations. If I isolate you, I can tell you horror stories of people taking a woman's clothes and the telephone and everything so she doesn't leave that house when he goes to work. Finally, one day, she just walked buck naked down the road and said, I need some help. And I think you never lose that fear. Once you've been in this situation, you never lose the fear. Your awareness is always heightened. And I think one thing I read in the book that really kept sticking with me is this family, it will never leave them. The rest of their lives, this stays with you. And what you choose to do with it, of course, is your choice. And it sounds like the kids have, you know, dealt really well and are moving on with their life. But it never leaves, and it makes you the person you are today.
Hannah, you write of a tracker's hope in your memoir, Point Last Seen. Would you explain what that is and how that has helped you and your family?
I think that one of the things that I learned to do when I was a search and rescue tracker was to have the ability to walk forward with every step, meaning the difference between life and death for that person up ahead. Every step mattered. The fact is, no matter how good a tracker you are, you may not be taking the right step at that particular time. You're taking the best step you know how to do. You're being as observant and aware as you know how to do. You're taking into account every single clue and hint that you can possibly take into account as you step forward, but you may not be on the right trail then. What tracking does, though, is that it convinces you that every single one of us, every step we make, every breath we make in this life, leaves a sign. We're not alone. We feel alone. We feel isolated. We seem by ourselves. He may have us locked in the house. He may have us where we haven't spoken to another human being in 6 weeks. That feels isolated. You feel like you're in solitary confinement, and it is just you who knows about you. But that is not so, because every human being leaves a sign, leaves a trail of their existence. And what tracking did was help me to learn to walk toward that, to walk just steadily, keep walking, no matter how bad it looked, toward the hope that at the other end of the line I was going to find that person that I was looking for, and in a very real sense also re-find myself every time that it did matter, that somehow getting through this whole thing did count. It would count for something good in the long run, and it has over and over again. And that's what tracking does, I think. Tracking is the ultimate exercise in hope and futility.
Sometimes frustration.
That too, yeah. Absolutely.
But it is a way to keep putting one foot in front of the other.
Right. And as my old grandmother in Mississippi always said, you know, you put one foot in front of the other, do the best you can do, and let the rough end drag. And that's about what you do in tracking. That's what the families who are on this front line are doing today. They are, you know, they're on the front lines of the battle, of a battle that we often don't even want to name very carefully. We want to tell ourselves we've got it fixed. And we want it to be somebody else, not us, as uncharitable as that sounds. But I have started asking, when I go around the country now, I've started asking a series of four questions. And one of them is, do you think this could ever happen to you? And most people, I say, half of the people in the audience, very hopefully, raise their hands and say no. And so I say, okay, then, have you ever, in any instance in your life, had a person that you love say something to you that belittled and demeaned you? Raise your hand. And every hand goes up. And I say, well, there it is. You're on the slide. You're on the slide on the victim side. And then you complicate that even further by talking about the other side of it, by the fact that any of us can be capable of this kind of violence. Any of us can be capable of this kind of control. And what we have to recognize is that we're on the slide whether we want to be or not, and then live up to our humanity by trying to make the world a safer place for people who are on the low end of the slide and moving fast.
Well, it's interesting you're telling us this now, because in your book also, the idea of becoming lost is something that you gained a new understanding of when you became a tracker. I mean, lost in the sense that how easy it is to get off the path in a national forest, or how easy it is to get off the path in your life.
Right, right. It's tremendously easy to do, I think, and speaking as someone with a great deal of experience at it, you know, of the getting lost, it's desperately easy to do, shockingly easy to do. We don't even know we're lost. A lot of the times we're walking through our lives not terribly mindful about what we're doing in them at all. We can be running so hard and meeting everybody's expectations so hard that we are not mindful at all of what's happening to us, what's going on, the little subtle changes that are turning that relationship of love and joy and soulmate, the relationship that you think is the core of your world, subtle changes can be going on in that can turn that into the most violent, torturous place you could imagine. And a lot of times we don't see those because we're not looking at that. I mean, particularly, I know when I love somebody, I don't find fault with their faults all the time. I look at their good sides. I bank on the good sides. I count on that. I take, you know, their bad sides just like I do mine. I try to deal with my bad sides and I try to sort them out. But, you know, I'm really responsible for that. And then you love somebody, you just love them. We don't often think about that. We tend to run past it and then look up one day and we're fairly thoroughly lost. We're in deep, serious trouble. One of the hopes that I have is that somehow we get this conversation started in grade school.
Exactly.
Because that's where it starts. That's where little kids find out it's okay to beat up on somebody or to belittle somebody for whatever reason. They find out it's okay to do that and get by with it, and it's cute and funny to some people. By the time our kids are getting into junior high, if they wait that long, young girls are commonly getting harassed in sexual ways. By the time you're in high school, I mean, it has gone over the line from harassment. You're into the line of petty assault, at least, in the halls, every time you walk down the hall. And somehow we've got to get to our little kids so that they start calling a halt to this, because they're the ones who are going to really change this, you know, for all our work.
We're talking this afternoon about family violence, and we have two guests with us today. On the telephone with us, Hannah Niala. She survived and escaped 7 years of physical and emotional abuse at the hands of her first husband. She's also the author of the memoir, Point Last Seen, A Woman Tracker's Story of Domestic Violence and Personal Triumph. And here with me in the studio, Tammy Tunnell. She's the program director for A Woman's Place, the Champaign-Urbana Domestic Violence The Champaign-Urbana Domestic Violence Shelter is one of the oldest in the country. This is the Afternoon Magazine. If you'd like to talk with us, give us a call. The phones are starting to light up. Here are the numbers, 333-9455. Toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Our first caller this afternoon is on line one in Urbana. Hi.
Hi. It's obviously a horrible problem, and I'm glad to hear you talk some about the cultural factors that I believe underlie domestic violence or family violence. I don't know whether I misheard you or not, but I do not believe I take great exception to the idea that anyone or everyone is capable of this level of violence or this level of this kind of behavior. Did I mishear you on that, or is that what you said, and is that what you believe?
No, you didn't mishear me, and I take great exception to it, too. But the fact is, the only way that I can come to terms with this kind of violence is to recognize that it's committed by human beings. And that means that people like me, in fact, I think Tammy can back me up on this, a lot of battered women proceed to batter their children. That was inconceivable to me. I did not understand it. And what I have come to from hearing so many people's stories about this is a place where I say, absolutely, every single one of us is capable of being a victim, capable of getting ourselves in where we don't see what's going on, and being the ones being hurt by this problem. But every single one of us also, I think, has the capability, the capacity for tremendous violence. We've got the capacity for good, but we've also got the capacity for violence. And once we accept that in ourselves, both of those possibilities, then we make reasoned, rational decisions every day, we hope, to wend toward the other direction, you know, to make a conscious decision not to be violent. But I think that we do, that is in our range of choices. And I think, I don't mean to be pushing this point too hard, but I really don't believe that we can solve this problem socially until everybody who's working on it recognizes in themselves the potential to be the bad guy in this. And so that's why I push that point.
I certainly do agree with you that if we don't work with the batterers in addition to the victims, we'll never solve the problem. And I think being able to see their humanity and see how this comes about is very, very important. I think your work is really, really important to that. And I do believe that every human being is capable of violence, but this kind of effort to control, this kind of use of violence is a decision. I mean, it is a choice that he makes. And I don't believe that most people are capable of making that choice, especially in an ongoing kind of way. And so maybe we just disagree on that. I also had a question about children, obviously, children that are in a home where this is going on are being harmed. And I can't understand why how a judge could make a decision that leaving children with someone who commits this kind of violence would be in the best interest of the child. And are lawyers using that kind of an argument to try to, you know, put the children with the woman who has been battered rather than leaving them with her husband? And I'll hang up and listen. I'd like to know more about how those decisions are made, because it's just insane to leave kids with somebody who's willing and capable and has made choices to use that kind of violence on people that he says he loves. Thank you very much.
Thanks. I'd like to make a comment on that. We don't know why, you know, judges decide what they decide. I think society still views children as an extension of an adult, their property. I don't think we treat children like they deserve to be treated and that they're human beings and they have rights too. And not enough places in the country have children's programs that deal with the domestic violence, family violence. We know that the effects on children are so far-reaching. They're even greater than what happens to the adults. And I agree we need to get into the schools, grade school. We actually have a program called CAP, Child Assault Prevention Project, that goes into even preschools. And we talk about personal safety issues, the bully on the playground. Somebody wants you to give them a kiss and you don't feel comfortable. It's okay. But we don't tell kids that. How many people do you know out there saying, "Oh, you know, give grandma a hug and a kiss"? Well, grandma is probably harmless, but we don't know that.
Nope.
Right. And, you know, Uncle Harry, we don't know that. A child has rights to not kiss people they don't want to kiss and hug. And we don't recognize that. I have a child who's almost five, and hitting is just absolutely not allowed in our household. And when she goes to the babysitter, she needs to know that it's not okay to hit people. And we started early. When she first started hitting people, we said, "No, you can't do that." And, I mean, it may sound overly zealous on my part, but look at where I work. And, you know, it's very important. We have to teach children how you resolve your conflicts. You don't go around punching people.
I want to ask Hannah a couple of questions about while you were in that house with your ex-husband and he was so abusive, he taunted you, he wanted you to fight.
Right.
And you would not.
Right. And that became the biggest source of his anger toward me.
But you had this mantra, I will not turn mean.
Right.
And part of that, I wonder if that fit in with how you wanted to protect your children. Because if you turned mean, that would be it, wouldn't it?
They had no one.
Yeah.
Not one single person in their life as a role model. But it was also a personal decision. Because after about 3 years in that marriage, every single thing that I had, every piece of individuality about me, the way I wore my hair or my clothes or the choice of what time to get up in the morning, everything that I had been taken away from me. My music. He cut all the tendons in my right hand. The doctors told me I'd never play the piano again. Piano had been a great source of a place for me to deal with frustration and that kind of thing, and it was gone all of a sudden, although I play now. Doctors don't know everything. But I would say probably about the third year, somewhere in the third year, all that I had was the little kernel inside me that had turned to nonviolence as a principle no matter what. I would not be violent. The only time I ever stood up to him and threatened violence was when he spanked my son, and I felt that he was out of line, and I told him that if he ever did it again, I would stop him. He got very, very angry when he realized that I really meant it. Taunted me, said, oh, you know, you're such a mouse, you never do anything. I said, I will kill you if you do that again. I really, seriously meant it. He went off threatening to kill himself, came back several hours later, but never laid a hand on the kids again while I was there. That was my line. But for myself, I had a vow of nonviolence, and that's all I had. That's the only thing that I could hang on to was deep inside, and I never said it outright to him. I never said, I vowed to be nonviolent no matter what. never got that philosophical and tidy and Hollywood-looking like. But he would beat me. So I literally could not stand up, and he would say, if you just hit back once, I'll quit. And all I had to hang on to was the fact that if given a choice, I would never lay my hand on another person in anger to harm them for any reason. And so I held on to that. But that was a personal choice and not one that, I don't actually know what would have happened if I had ever hit him. I did not contemplate it. He probably would have killed me. So maybe it was some, deeply buried instinct for self-preservation. I prefer to think that it was just my spirit crying out for something to hang on to.
Yeah.
And it turned out well for my children in the long run, although they lived with him for my daughter for 2 years, my son for 4 years, and came back tremendously scarred. They were abducted again in 1991 after he had threatened to kill them again. They've been terribly scarred by it, and for a few years, my daughter just outright told me, this nonviolent stuff, I'm going to get mean and tough, and she's got a blue belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu and is as tough as nails. but she's now verging on 18 and has been safe enough long enough to recognize that there is some extreme value in not choosing that road, and to be choosing it for herself now. So I feel like it has worked for us.
Yeah. I want to thank you, Hannah, very much for talking with us this afternoon. And I also want to mention to folks that Point Last Seen is a book worth reading, whether or not family violence is touching your life, because I think it is, it's a wonderful book for just thinking about where you are in life and where you want to go, and really, really nice writing. I would really highly recommend it. I want to thank you. Also this afternoon, I want to thank Tammy Tunnell. She's the program director for A Woman's Place. Tammy, you want to give us the phone number for A Woman's Place?
The 24-hour hotline number is 384-4390. It's answered 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There's always somebody there.
Okay, and Hannah's book is Point Last Seen, A Woman Tracker's Story of Domestic Violence and Personal Triumph. It's out in paper from Penguin.